Morning, everybody. Today's date is Saturday, March 14th. I guess that makes it Pi Day. I'm Tom Kaczynski. This is Coronavirus Central, your one-stop shop for the ongoing coronavirus epidemic, COVID-19. I want to thank you for being with us here on the Saturday show. As always, all of our episodes are at coronaviruscentral.net. Join our Telegram group, t.me/coronaviruscentral. It's an open source intelligence network. All are welcome. Just have to behave yourself like you would on any other forum. And we have over 1,300 members, including many professionals who are sharing information, evidence, research to give you the best information we can in this world about what's happening with this terrible outbreak. So today's show is going to be a little bit lighter in the one sense. I'm trying to keep it down because, frankly, my throat is dead. I literally talked 8 hours yesterday, and I'm still a little raspy, so I apologize for that for the listeners. And I'm hoping to use a little time this weekend to take care of some back-end things and some personal things as well to give you a better show experience next week as we go into the midst of this. And as we go forward with it, you know, it would be very easy to just dump story after story on you about infection. I think at this point we sort of understand that this is everywhere, and we're all going to walk through it. So we're going to always keep the focus on the evolving science, the protection that keeps you safe, and to help you realize what you're going to be dealing with, not just in terms of the virus, which is the heart of this show, but the disruptions it's going to cause and what that means for your daily life. So we're going to jump right into it here, and I want to share with you the latest global numbers. We're going to look at two pieces of information about what this virus does, one that's going to be troubling, one that's potentially good news, so that's a welcome break. We're going to check in with the Italians, see how rough this is, and then we're going to take a little bit of look at some additional modeling here, and that'll be today's show. So COVID19info.live is where we're going to start here. Always recommend them, as well as our good friends at COVIDReport.net. They do an excellent job compiling information, getting stories out there, letting you know what's happening, and giving you the opportunity to figure this out for yourself as we go through this pandemic together. And hopefully you're listening to this while you're either comfortably ensconced in your domicile so you don't go infect others or yourself, or getting that last-minute shopping done. Hopefully you went somewhere quiet where people weren't at. And I want to thank also all the people who tuned into the show on YouTube last night, answered a lot of questions. And if you want a more personal, calibrated approach to a lot of the things that are out there, highly recommend joining us Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 7 p.m. I always swear the show is going to be 1 hour, and then I leave at 9, so take that for what it's worth. Okay, so COVID19info.live update, 7:20 a.m. on the U.S. East Coast, March 14th, 2020. 146,945 confirmed cases, 5,471 confirmed deaths. So China, it was still at 8,973 with 3,193 deaths claimed. Italy, 17,660 confirmed cases, 1,266 deaths, a current CFR of 7.2. Keep in mind the testing was running behind, so that will bring it down, but we are starting to see a very high casualty rate in Italy. Iran, 12,364 confirmed cases, and that number might be quite a bit higher, 541 deaths. You know, I've actually had some Chinese people reach out to us because some of them have been able to get some information. A lot of people, apparently in Wuhan, they claim, or potentially died in place in their apartments, and they're not getting caught in any statistics. So let's hope that that doesn't happen here. I'm not saying it to scare you. I just am saying it because while we're in quarantine, the people who are ill, who are not able to get there, who aren't emergency services, they're at threat. And that's why we tell you that what you absolutely need to do is make every effort to not contract this. It's a good time to stay at home. You're going to have to be there for a while. I understand. Get what you need. You know, we've said on this show that 30 days is a good start. I am telling you now, based on things that we'll talk about later, 90 days is what you probably want to aim for. And if you have to ration and some of those things, we'll talk about that later in the show in the last segment. Some ideas about how to prep out your survival based on the resources you have. So there's a lot of things you can do. It won't be pleasant in some cases, but you will make it if you're intelligent about it. All right, more countries. And Western Europe is just going to get the brunt of this. I don't know how else to put it. We have 5,232 cases in Spain, with 133 deaths. We have 3,675 cases in Germany with 8 deaths. France, 3,667 cases, 79 deaths. The United States now passes 2,000, 2,176, 47 deaths. Switzerland, 1,139, 11 deaths. And these are countries that we're reading here with smaller populations, these next few, that are on the same basic trail when you factor in the fact that they are far smaller. So Norway, 996 and 1. Denmark, 875 and 0. Sweden, 814 and 2. The Netherlands, 804 and 10. The UK here at 801 and 11. The US and the UK seem to be going at about the same pace. Japan in that group as well, 734 and 21. Belgium, 559 and 3. Austria, 504 and 1. And then beneath that, you have smaller clusters that have to do probably more with the testing. For our listeners in Australia, 200 with 3 cases. And Canada, 198 with 1. So, and Singapore's only at 200. They've done an amazing job. It just shows you what could be different if you get in front of this caseload. Or if you also have masks, because they understood that because they had dealt with SARS and H1N1. And the reality is we've been lucky and dodged the bullet a lot in the West. But this time we're going to have to take it on the chin. And that's okay. We'll do it. We're tough like that. Okay, so first story we're going to come out with here today is from the South China Morning Post. There's a number of different people covering it, but I wanted to get this out there. I think it's important. This is by Elizabeth Chung. Coronavirus. Some recovered patients may have reduced lung function and are left gasping for air while walking briskly, Hong Kong doctors find. Hospital authority releases its findings after observing the first group of discharged coronavirus patients. Some patients might have a drop of about 20 to 30% in lung function, says medical director of Infectious Disease Center at the Princess Margaret Hospital. Some patients who recovered from COVID-19 have suffered reduced lung function and now experience problems such as gasping for air when walking quickly, the Hong Kong's hospital authorities have revealed. The authority released its findings on Thursday after observing the first group of discharged coronavirus patients. The city has so far recorded 131 confirmed cases of COVID-19, including 3 fatalities. Of them, 74 patients have been discharged, while one probable coronavirus case has also recovered. Dr. Owen Song Tak Yin, medical director of the authority's Infectious Disease Center at the Princess Margaret Hospital in Kwai Chung, said doctors had already seen around a dozen discharged patients in follow-up appointments. 2 or 3 were unable to do things they had done in the past. They gasp if they walk a bit more quickly, Sang told a media briefing on Thursday. Some patients might have around a drop of 20 to 30% in lung function after recovery. Song, who also heads an authority task force on the clinical management of infections, said these patients would undergo tests to determine how much lung function they still had. Physiotherapy would also be arranged to strengthen their lungs. So we know that there's this damage. We don't know how permanent it is. We do know fibrosis is something we expect from this. And this maybe speaks to the question of, you know, what happens to survivors, especially the people who have, more acute cases, at least as one short-term effect that you have to deal with if you happen to get afflicted with coronavirus. All right, a review of lung scans of 9 infected patients at Princess Margaret found a pattern similar to frosted glass in all of them, suggesting there was organ damage. But Song said the long-term effect on recovered patients, such as whether they would develop pulmonary fibrosis, a condition where lung tissue hardened and the organ could not function properly, had yet to be ascertained. He said discharged patients could do cardiovascular exercise, such as swimming, to help the lungs recover gradually. The city's public hospitals are about to conduct clinical trials on remdesivir, a drug originally developed to treat Ebola, to see how effective it is on COVID-19. Let's see. The drug had already been delivered to hospitals. Doctors would begin identifying suitable patients to join the trials, which were expected to begin in the middle of the month. He stressed that the drug could lead to some complications, such as affecting liver function and leading to inflammation of the blood vessels. COVID-19 patients are being treated with Keletra, probably a drug originally for HIV/AIDS, Ribavirin, which was used for Hep C, and interferon. So there's just a little bit of treatment in there. I've read a couple doctors' reports that aren't so keen on Keletra, but we'll see. You know, it's early. I don't know what's going to be the case. But what I wanted to say is, you know, organ damage is something that we're seeing, you know, not just necessarily with the lungs, but I think there's the potential, given what's impacted with the ACE, anywhere there's an ACE2 receptor is somewhere that they're going to have to look. That could be heart, that could be liver, that could be kidneys. We'll see. It's really early. And, you know, what are the long-term impacts of this? We don't know. So one of the questions that we've asked in the second story is about this, is what happens with reinfection? How quickly do you get reinfected? How long do you carry this for? And I have a piece from the Los Angeles Times here that's going to go into that a little bit. Keeping in mind, this is talking about reinfection and saying that why people test positive again, and this article at least uses some evidence to make the case that at least in the short term, we aren't seeing reinfection. Now, the question of why someone gets sick a second time from something they've had and whether or not they have antibodies and how long they last are open questions that we're only really going to know in time and that will be highly contingent upon the extent to which COVID-19 ends up mutating into different strains. In the same way that you get the flu different ways because the virus changes, that could happen with this coronavirus. We can't know that this early in. What this article does speak to, however, is some of the risks of reinfection in a way that should actually, if accurate, be comforting, that perhaps once you get this, you have at least a substantial interval before the same strain can be reinfective. So the article is titled, "They Survived the Coronavirus and They Tested Positive Again. Why?" And this is by Alice Su, the China correspondent, posted at 5 a.m. yesterday on the 13th. Beijing. The neighbors were free at last. After weeks of confinement to their apartments because one person in the building had tested coronavirus, they were throwing a party to celebrate his recovery and their release. It was February 24th, and Mr. Wang, a resident of Huzhou in the Jiangsu province, appeared to have emerged victorious from a month-long battle with the illness. 65 residents of his building gathered downstairs to greet him with bouquets of pink flowers, a cake with a flamingo on it, and a red banner that read, "With strong neighborly feelings, we welcome you home." And they pressed in close around him for a group photo that was captured in a local news video. 3 days later, though, Wang tested positive for the coronavirus again. He was rehospitalized and his neighbors were locked down once more. His current condition is unknown. Wang, whose full name has not been disclosed for privacy reasons, is more than 100 reported cases of Chinese patients who have been released from hospitals as survivors of the new coronavirus, only to test positive for it a second time in the bewildering math of this mysterious illness. The science surrounding these apparent reinfections is further complicated by China's handling of the outbreak, which since January has been marred by faulty testing procedures and questionable case counting methods with shifting definitions. In addition, the overburdened healthcare system has put pressure on doctors to discharge people who may have not been fully recovered to free up beds for newly infected patients. China has been praised in recent weeks by the WHO for containing the virus, but the Communist Party's early moves to suppress public knowledge on the extent of infections prompt concerns over the accuracy of information about recovered patients who retest positive but may have been misdiagnosed in the first place. Such cases count for less than 0.2% of China's total infections, not enough to cause alarm. But they are raising questions in China about the reliability of diagnostic tests, the possibility of reinfection, and whether patients are wrongly designated as recovered and released too early from hospitals. Although most patients who retest positive do not display clinical symptoms, some have developed fevers and other signs of the virus. One such patient, a 36-year-old man, died in Wuhan on March 2nd, 5 days after being declared recovered. His diagnosis, according to hospital reports published in local media before they were censored, was respiratory tract obstruction, respiratory failure, and COVID-19, the official name for the illness caused by the coronavirus. China's National Health Commission says 64,216 out of the 80,991 confirmed COVID-19 patients have recovered, and 3,179 have died. There is no official record of how many recovered patients have retested positive and returned to hospital, but such cases have been reported in the provinces of Hubei, Guangdong, Hainan, Sichuan, Jiangsu, and the cities of Tianjin and Chongqing. In Guangdong, the Officials responsible for the coronavirus response announced on February 25th that 14% of the declared recoveries had later retested positive. This dynamic is also playing out in other countries. Two such cases have emerged in Japan and South Korea, though the Korean patient has been released from the hospital after retesting negative 5 times. Scientists in and outside China agree that reinfection is a highly unlikely explanation for patients who retest positive. They say testing errors are more likely to blame either false negatives that resulted in patients being discharged too early or false positives when they retested and were taken back to the hospital. Those errors could be attributed to contaminated test samples, human error while taking swabs, or an oversensitive nucleic acid test that detects strands of virus. When a person gets sick with any kind of viral infection, their immune system naturally develops antibodies that should protect them from contracting the illness again after they've recovered. Even in cases where that immunity wears off, it shouldn't be as quick within a few days or weeks, said Dr. Keiji Fukuda, director of Hong Kong University School of Public Health. If you get an infection, your immune system is revved up against that virus. To get reinfected again when you're in that situation would be quite unusual unless your immune system was not functioning right. Now, I just want to pull a piece out of this there. One thing that we have been curious about in the beginning of this was the question of what sort of immunosuppressive capacity COVID has, because that will play a large role in how quickly the people get reinfected, as well as the severity of the disease. We talked about that HIV appearing spike protein and the idea that there might be permanent infections based upon what testing comes back. So this article seems to suggest that that is less of a concern, but we'll have to keep an eye on it because the evidence is still, evolving on this. But anyway, the article suggests what's more likely is that people are being released from hospitals while still carrying dormant fragments of the disease that are not infectious but resemble the virus when put through a nucleic acid test. The test may be positive, but the infection is not there, he said. Another possibility is that the level of virus fell below the threshold the test could detect but then resurfaced, said Dr. Clifford Lane, Deputy Director for Clinical Research and Special Projects at the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases. So it looks like they cleared the virus and then the virus came back, Lane said. But they never really cleared it and they had a more prolonged course of infection. Lane was one of only two U.S. experts in a World Health Organization delegation that visited China in February. He said Chinese experts told the visitors there were no examples of people who became reinfected. The best way to prove reinfection, Lane said, would be to sequence the genomes of the initial and subsequent viruses that circulated in a patient. If there's a difference between the two, that would suggest the virus had mutated enough to evade the patient's antibodies and prompt a second infection. Developing a vaccine would be significantly more difficult if the virus is changing fast enough to cause true reinfections. It would undermine the immunity patients developed from natural infections. It's too early to know the true cause of these apparent reinfections, Lane said, especially because the cases are so rare. These are exceptions, he added, they are not the rule. Another potential explanation is that some patients may also have been discharged too early because of pressure on hospitals to free up beds for new patients. If you don't discharge them, who's going to save the other patients? You need to make trade-offs, one unnamed doctor said in a report by the paper, a Shanghai-based news outlet. A doctor at a Wuhan hospital told the paper he'd seen discharged patients still using oxygen tanks, having trouble walking, and displaying obvious clinical symptoms, including serious lung infections in February. Some of the recovered patients had worse clinical symptoms than the new mild cases entering the hospitals, he said. But the situation improved in late February when fewer patients turned up at Wuhan's hospitals, enabling them to keep patients longer. Chinese authorities claim that none of the patients who tested positive again infected others. If true, it's an encouraging sign that even if some discharged patients are still carrying low levels of the virus, they are not contagious. But one study by Chinese scientists published last month in the Journal of the American Medical Association raised questions about testing. The study examined 4 medical workers in Wuhan, all infected with coronavirus, and then declared recovered according to national criteria. But 5 to 13 days after the 4 were released from quarantine, they all tested positive again. They were then each given 3 repeat tests over the next 4 to 5 days. All were positive. Dr. Dale Fisher, professor of medicine at the National University of Singapore and another participant in the WHO China delegation, said the apparent reappearance of coronavirus in recovered patients was probably because of excessive testing and follow-up on discharge cases in China. The outbreak is being driven by people who are spreading it in those first 5 days while they're symptomatic and before they're isolated. One, people are going around coughing and undiagnosed infecting people. The things to worry about are the other end of the illness. So that's what they claim. What weight you want to put in that, I don't know. But it does show that there are different reasons that could be possible. Are people getting released from hospitals too early? Are they reinfecting others? Do they never really get fully over? And it goes into sort of a, I guess if it was cancer, you would call it remission. That's not the right word here, but it gets the concept across. We don't know, but this is something we're going to keep an eye on moving forward because it's a big part of the story, as this may very well come in waves. And especially if there are new strains found, whatever antibodies exist may have limited efficacy or reduced efficacy against the new strain. And we already know that there have been two strains. We know a lot of people have gotten this worldwide. And the more places the virus gets into, in theory, the more opportunities there are for the evolution of a new and divergent strain that could potentially reinfect people, or I should say infect for in a new sense, because it is functionally operating in a different way. We're going to shift now over to Italy here and give you an update. In a lot of ways, we have all this information from China and we have a little bit from South Korea. Iran is apparently in really bad shape, and we can give little hints and pieces, but that's not, our neck of the world, let's say, in terms of where we get information from, especially in the West, whereas Italy is a country with which we are quite familiar, and then in a lot of ways has a similar system to what we have. So what they are experiencing there, and in terms of the quality of data and in terms of the likely responses, I think has more relevance, especially in these moments, in these few weeks before we're going to get pounded, to really understand what we're going to deal with. So I want to spend a little time focusing on what's going on there. We're going to have two pieces here. The first one is going to cover the news portion of it, and the other one is going to cover it from a personal perspective of a person living in Italy who has been watching this. So I really think people have come from a position of thinking this is not a problem we have to deal with, or this is just something we have to prevent, to a place of understanding that this is now a life-changing event. And with the level of gravity and seriousness, one thing that I want to try to do and literally figure out for myself as well is what do we really expect? And sometimes personal experience allows that. But before we do that, we're going to cover this piece from the New York Post. This was written by Amanda Woods at 10 o'clock last night. Coronavirus in Italy is like a world war as death toll soars. Italy recorded 250 coronavirus deaths in a 24-hour period, the most in the country in a single day, as the number of COVID-19 fatalities there reached 1,266, according to the official data released Friday. The country also recorded more than 2,500 new cases of the virus in that period, bringing the total to more than 17,000. A nurse in northern Italy that said that fighting the virus was like being in the middle of a world war. Hospitals like this one in Brescia are packed as Italy battles the scourge, which earlier this week took the life of Dr. Roberto Stella, 67, the head of a medical association in a region heavily hit by the virus. So you can see that it's really getting bad, and we've told a lot of stories. There's a lot of videos up there. I've been posting them at CoronavirusCast. What you would see is you would see medical triage hospitals where you see cots set up, you see people going around in full protective gear. A heroic effort by the Italian medical service, especially in the hardest hit northern parts of Italy. And you're starting to see that ramp up happening in places like Spain. France is coming online, Germany, Switzerland's got it pretty bad, the Netherlands has a mess going on. A lot of those countries in Western Europe, Sweden's another one. But ultimately, you are seeing that, they're trying to get in front of this. There are shortages in supplies. There's a lot of concerns. Nicholas Kristof from New York Times reported we're starting to see that in the United States. He said on Twitter earlier today that they were 4 days away from running out of gloves at the hospitals in Seattle because they're just having to, for safety reasons, transfer them out so much. And we hope the government's effort is improving to get to that. We'll talk about that a little bit at the end of the show. I didn't want that to be the focal point today because we talk about that a lot. And I'm sure we will be talking about the things they need to do, are not doing, and are starting to do at exhaustive, deliberative depth. Apologies for my poor pronunciation. So I want to go ahead and build on that little update that we had there about the number of deaths continuing to rise. And the quarantine taking effect. Keep in mind that even though the quarantine's been in effect in Italy for a few days, we have this sort of long incubation, asymptomatic period where the cases are very mild. That means from whenever you put the quarantine out there, let's call it 10 days, maybe 14 days, could be less, where the case numbers really are not present in terms of what you see in the population because they're going forward. And that's one of the reasons why this show has been arguing for a quarantine very quickly and for people to stay home, with however much relish you need to put on that. So this was published on Reddit, and I will share this. This is on Reddit's called China Flu because this goes back a little while ago. But this is from an Italian to the rest of the world where you don't have any idea what's coming. And they've verified, I guess, that this is an Italian citizen. I just want to read this story here. Their first language is not English, so keep in mind if they say things wrong, I'm just going to read it as they wrote it. But I want you to have a feel for what they experienced because what we will experience in the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, Western Europe, a lot of the developed world, Japan probably, maybe a little different there, is going to be similar to this adapted to our own countries, which have unique problems. Okay. First thing, I am sorry for any eventual grammar errors, but English is not my first language. Second, this is a repost from another sub because they asked me, but it doesn't accept it. So, all right, so this is from an Italian person, and I've seen the repost. It does go back. As I think everyone knows, Italy is on quarantine because of the coronavirus outbreak. That means everybody has to stay home unless you've got valid reasons to go out. The situation is bad, but what's seeing the rest of the world behaving as if it isn't going to happen to them? We know what you're thinking because we were in your place too. Let's see how this whole thing developed, and keep in mind it happened in around 2 weeks. Stage 1. You know the coronavirus exists and the first cases begin to appear in your country. Well, nothing to worry about. It's just a bad flu. I mean, I'm not 75 years or older, so what could possibly happen to me? I'm safe. Everyone's overreacting. What's the need to go out with masks and stock toilet paper? I'm going to live my life as usual. There's no need to freak out. Stage 2. The number of cases begins to be significant. They declare a red zone and quarantine one or two small cities where they found the first cases and a lot of people were infected. And she dates this back to February 22nd. Well, that's sad and somewhat worrisome, but they're taking care of it, so nothing to panic about. There are some deaths, but they're all old people with other pathologies, so the media is just trying to create panic for views. How shameful. People lead their life as usual. I mean, I'm not going to stop going out and meeting my friends, am I? There's no need to. It's not going to get me. Everyone's fine here. Stage 3. The number of cases is rapidly going up. They almost doubled in one day. There's more death. They declare red zones and quarantine the four regions where the majority of cases are registered. This is March 7th. So look at how much time elapsed here. You're talking about 2 weeks. In Italy, at this point, a quarter of the country is under quarantine. Schools and universities close in these areas, but bars, workplaces, restaurants, and so on are still open. The decree gets released by some newspaper before it should, so around 10,000 people from the red zone escape to the area the same night to return to their homes in the rest of Italy. This will be important later. Most of the population of the remaining three quarters of Italy still does what it always does. A portion of the quarantine, too. They still don't realize the seriousness of the situation. I mean, yes, everywhere you turn, they talk about the coronavirus, they talk to wash your hands and limit your going out. Assemblies of large people are forbidden and so on. Every 5 minutes on TV, they remind you of these rules. But it still hasn't settled in people's minds. Stage 4. The number of cases is heavily increasing. Schools and universities are closed everywhere for at least a month. It's a national health emergency. Hospitals are at capacity. Entire units are cleared to make space for coronavirus patients. There aren't enough doctors and nurses. They're calling retired ones and those who are in the last 2 years of university. So there's no shifts anymore. Just work as much as you can. Of course, doctors and nurses are getting infected, spreading it to their families and so on. There's too many cases of pneumonia, too many people who need ICU, and not enough places for everybody. The same goes for ventilators. At this point, it's like being at war. Doctors have to choose who to treat based on their survival chance. That means the elderly, the trauma, stroke patients can't get treated because corona patients have the priority. There's not enough resources for everybody, so they have to be distributed for the best outcome. I wish I was joking, but it's literally what has been happening. People died because there was no more space. I have a doctor friend who called me devastated because he had to let three people die that day. Nurses crying because they see people dying from them and can't do anything besides offering some oxygen. A friend's relative died yesterday because of corona because they couldn't treat him. Chemos have been delayed until further notice. It's chaos. The system is collapsing. Coronavirus and the crisis it's provoking is all you hear about everywhere. Stage 6. 2 days later, it's announced that all businesses are closed. Bars, restaurants, shopping centers, all kinds of shops, etc. Everything except supermarkets and pharmacies. You can move around only if you have an auto certification with you, an official document in which you declare your name, where you're coming from, where you're going, and what you're there for. There are a lot of police checkpoints. If you're found outside without a valid reason, you risk a fine. And if you're a known positive patient, you risk 1 to 12 years for jail for homicide. So that's what the situation is like now as of today, March 12th. Keep in mind, it all happened in around 2 weeks, 5 days from stage 3 to now. The rest of the world, apart from Italy, China, and Korea, is just beginning to reach the other stages. So let me tell you this. You have no idea what's coming to get you. I know because 2 weeks ago, I was the one who had no idea and thought it wasn't that bad. But it is. And it's not because the virus alone is particularly dangerous or deadly, but for all the consequences it brings. It's hard to see all these countries act like it's not coming and not take the precautions that are necessary for the well-being of their citizens while they still can. So please, if you're reading this, try to act in your own best interest. This problem will not solve itself by ignoring it. Just wondering how many undiscovered cases there might be in America alone is scary, and they're in for big, big trouble because of how their country, our country, is run. Our government for once did a good job, I must say. The actions taken were drastic but necessary, and this may be the only way to limit the spreading. It's working in China, so we hope it'll work here too, and it's already working in some of the first red zones, which were quarantined before anyone else. Also, they're taking measures to protect us citizens, such as suspending mortgage payments for the next month, help for shop owners who are obligated to close, and so on. I realize these takes are really difficult, if not impossible, to take in some of the countries, which she means is actions. It's really worrying to think about what it could mean on a global scale. I wonder if this pandemic will be a turning point in our society. What do you think? So guys, if there are cases where you live and the virus is spreading, you're maybe 1 or 2 weeks behind us. You'll get to our point eventually. And please, please, please take any precaution you can. Don't act like it's not going to get you. And if you can, stay home. TLDR, that's too long, didn't read. Italy is in quarantine. People didn't take the corona threat seriously. Then a quarter of Italy was put on quarantine. The number of cases was so high that the healthcare system collapsed, required a quarantine for the whole country to slow the spreading and give everyone the opportunity to get treated. It is bad. Stay home. And we don't know. I mean, right now, that's as of 2 days ago. Have they turned a corner? We don't know. It's too early. We don't know because we don't know what China went through, how bad it got. We do know that the only way you can protect yourself from this and from all the consequences that accrue to it is you have to take responsibility for yourself. Things seem to be accelerating in the United States. Our testing has been anemic. More people traveled here than anywhere else. We don't know what we don't know. Could there be so many cases that we are in an absolutely devastating status? I hope not. You would think that if that was the case, that we would have seen somewhat more evidence at the hospitals of how bad this was. But we see cases. We see around our country presumed positive cases. People who the CDC tested, who, you know, they said went away. And, you know, I don't know. But I do know that this is spreading. This is getting big. And that we need to act in a really big way to stop it. And we need to act. For every week we delay, you're putting many lives, including the medical responders, that you will need at risk. So we've been saying for some time you need to be getting to self-quarantine. If you're not, this consider your last weekend to get ready. I don't expect you to go without food and supplies. If you have not done so already, get ready to sit in place. You should be spending St. Patrick's Day at home with your family, just, you know, talking with your loved ones. If there are people you want to hole in with because you're not going to be able to move, this is a great time to get there. If you have travel you need to do, Do it today. Do it tomorrow. Be in place by Monday. The quarantines must be coming. Italy went from 0 to 60. You're seeing this start to happen in Spain. We've talked about them a little bit. They're upping their thing. France is going to do it. The UK says they're not going to do it. We'll see about that. The United States is moving in that direction as well for those listening here. And we will see that in Australia. We've even seen, you know, and this is not a political thing, man. The New Zealand Prime Minister, who's known as a pretty far left-wing person, is shutting down borders faster than the far right. And you know, I just said jokingly, you got to shut down contact between people. Every one of us is a potential carrier. The numbers are still probably low in terms of being a percentage, but they're high enough that you need to be in optimum protection when you're going out. That's mask, that's goggles, and don't let yourself get hurt. That's really what we want here. So that's a story from Italy of what someone experienced on the ground. You know, how much credence you want to put in that. I know 20,000 people have seen it, and now another 20,000 people have heard this. This is Coronavirus Central. I'm Tom Kaczynski, your host, trying to bring you the best information of what's going on out there on the ground so that you can know what's happening. So the next piece we're going to do is going to be much more caught up in, how should I put it, in the modeling of this. And a lot of people have heard about flattening the curve. All right, there are all these things out there saying that epidemiologically what we want to do, and this is very true, is we want to have less cases at once so that the health system is not overrun. That, in theory, is a very good idea. But Joshua Bash went out here, or Bach, I apologize. Joshua Bach went out, and he was out presenting an argument for why flattening the curve is a deadly delusion. And what this article is going to talk about is that you see the nice models on TV and on the internet that say that, you know, that there's this horrible bump, spike of cases that could happen. And conversely, there's this long, gradual curve that doesn't go above the healthcare capacity. And that the expectation that's being fostered is that the actions we are doing now will flatten the curve to the point where we stay beneath that saturation point. And what his argument basically sums up to is that we acted too late and there's too many cases, and it would take too long to not have a bunch of really bad things happen in a short time. Does that mean that flattening the curve is not a good idea? Of course not. If you can cut 10 million people dying to 5 million dying, that is a heroic effort that we have to make. But this article is a hard one to read, but it's important, so I'm going to take the time to read it for you, at least big chunks of it, because it's rather long, but it's important for you to understand what we're dealing with, and as part of the preparation that I want to share with you mentally in terms of our own expectations. You have an on-the-ground report of how quickly this is going to come. This modeling, I think, offers a plausible estimate of what we might see on the back end. You're going to hear a lot of themes about the problems we've talked about on this show, and it will add a little more detail, though, as to sort of the modeling and expectations from a different source than myself, right? It's very important to state that none of us know what the specific model looks like, and the model is always incredibly contingent and dependent on the acts of government, the availability of supply, the value of the healthcare system, and most importantly, the behavior of the people themselves. The virus spreads through us. When we change our behaviors, we reduce its efficacy. And that's the most important point that we do on this show. And that's what we say to you. Hygiene, yes. Masks, yes. Goggles, yes. Quarantine, yes. Whatever you can do to minimize your risk, yes. Okay. Flattening the curve is a deadly delusion. You have all seen a version of this curve of the COVID-19 caseloads by now. And for those who obviously you can't see, you see a bell curve shaped distribution where there's one big spike that says cases without protection, and you see a much wider, lower hill-like spike of cases with protective measures. And he goes through these. What all these, and he shows like a couple diagrams. What these diagrams have in common, one, they have no numbers on the axes. They don't give you an idea how many cases it takes to overwhelm the medical system and over how many days it will play out. Number two, they suggest that currently the medical system can deal with a large fraction, like maybe two-thirds or one-thirds of the cases, but if we implement some mitigation measures, we can get the infections per day down to a level we can deal with. And I will just say my own estimate, for what it's worth, is that when 1 in 1,000 people gets infected, or say 1 in 200 have a severe infection, the American medical system will be overrun. And if I had to make a guess based on the European system with their lesser capacity. I would say that number is when you get to 1 in 4 or 500 who have this in a severe amount, which would be consonant with a number of people having cases 1 in 2,000 in your country. So, and the reason for that is caught up in the number of ventilators, supplies, ICU, and we're going to get into that in this article. Number three, they mean to tell you we can get away without severe lockdowns as we are currently observing them in China and Italy. Instead, we let the infection burn through the entire population until we have herd immunity at 40 to 70%. And Chris Martinson's actually argued, based on an R-naught of 4, that you would have, which would be an intrinsic R-naught, you would have herd immunity probably happen around 70-some percent. But if the R-naught, or I should say 75%, if the R-naught is closer to 6 or 7, you got to get to, well, 85% before this starts being something that can heat up again in terms of going out there. And there's a lot of papers about herd immunity. Suffice it to say, the relationship is the higher the transmissibility, the more people have to have had it in order to have the herd immunity protection of saying that it can't spread between people because people can't carry it. It gets killed in the antibodies of the population. And anyway, so this just spaces the infections over a longer time span. But he says, the curve is a lie. Bach says, these suggestions are dangerously wrong, and if implemented, will lead to incredible suffering and hardship. Let's try to understand this by putting some numbers on the axes. Question one, what is the capacity of the healthcare system? This is a difficult question and cannot be answered in a short post like this. The United States has about 924,100 hospital beds, or 2.8 per 1,000 people. California, which if you convert, it's about 1 in 400. California has only 1.8. Countries like Germany have 8. South Korea has 12. Their hospital system got overloaded nonetheless. Most of these beds are in use, but we can create more using improvisation, for instance, using hotels, school gyms, and other strategic resources of the military, National Guard, and other organizations. In fact, we're expecting to see this in hotels, college dorms. That's one of the reasons some of us think the colleges are being emptied out now, and field hospitals, which will happen. Based on Chinese data, we can estimate that about 20% of COVID-19 patients are severe and require hospitalization. However, many severe cases will survive if they can be provided adequately at home, which may include oxygens, IVs, and isolation. And one of the points, just to, not that it's good news, but to add to this, is that it wasn't enough in Italy for a lot of cases to just have oxygen. They actually needed the ventilators because of the damage. The scarring to the lungs was sufficient enough that absent them, the people were not able to breathe. And that's been one of the choke points in this, just to put a little detail. But for less severe cases, obviously oxygen is useful. More important is the number of ICU beds, which some estimates can be stretched, which by some estimates can be stretched to about 100,000, and of which about 30,000 may be available. And also, he didn't include this, but you can take the general OR and probably add about 30, 40,000 into that. So there are a couple more out there, but once again, not numbers enough. About 5% of all COVID-19 cases need intensive care, and without it, all of them will die. We can also increase the number of ICU beds somewhat, but the equipment that we need to deal with sepsis, kidney, liver, and heart failure, severe pneumonia, cannot be stretched arbitrarily between them. An important part of the equation are ventilators. Most of the critically ill COVID-19 cases die of an infection of the lungs that makes it impossible to breathe and even destroys so much tissue that the blood can no longer be sufficiently oxygenated. These patients need intubation and mechanical ventilation to give them a chance of survival, or even an ECMO machine. These are pretty rare, but what they do is they oxygenate the blood directly. About 6% of all cases need a ventilator, and if hospitals put all existing ventilators to use, we have about 160,000 of them. In addition, the CDC has a strategic stockpile of 8,900 ventilators that can be deployed in hospitals that need them. If we take the number of ventilators as a proximate limit on the medical resources, it means we can take care of up to 170,000 critical ill patients at the same time. So whether he listens to the show or not, he's come to the same conclusion that we came to 3 days ago, that ventilators are going to be the key choke point, and we know that because that's what the Italian doctors told us. How many people will get infected? Without containment, the virus becomes endemic, and leading epidemiologists like Mark Lipsitch, and we mentioned him in our Boston studies, and Christian Drotzen from Berlin, estimate that between 40 and 70% of the population get infected until we develop some degree of herd immunity. Unfortunately, we do not know how long this immunity lasts. We already observe multiple strains of COVID-19, and we will see many, many more due to the large numbers of carriers. In a population like the United States, that means between 327 million. We've been using 330, but that's fine. That means between 130 million and 230 million. Let's assume that 55% of the U.S. population, the middle ground, get infected between March and December, so we would be looking at 180 million people. Next question, what about undetected, mild, and asymptomatic cases? In the early days of the infection, many outside observers were highly skeptical of the Chinese numbers and thought that they might hide magnitudes of undetected, mild, and asymptomatic cases, which means the mortality is much lower than reported. The WHO delegation to China, led by Bruce Aylward, found this not to be the case. And I'm going to interject here that the WHO delegation to China was a political rubber stamp that I'm not going to put a whole lot of confidence in. But nonetheless, Aylward maintains that once enough resources were available, Chinese testing was very thorough, although we reported today that they have a ton of questions, again, and only a fraction of infected cases have been missed. Even mild and asymptomatic cases of COVID-19 are infections, so they matter. So that's an optimistic assumption, but who knows, maybe you need some optimism. How many people will get critically ill? Of the 180 million, 80 million will be regarded as mild cases. Some of them will have no symptoms at all. Many of them will come down with a flu-like disease that lasts for 2 weeks, and which may include pneumonia, but they will get better on their own usually within 2 to 3 weeks. And just so you know, when they say mild, mild is still really miserable. If you've ever had pneumonia or severe influenza, you feel like death warmed over. So don't think that, you know, surviving this alone means that you're going to have a nice time if you get this. It really is unpleasant from what we've read from different cases. And you don't know how badly it's going to impact you, especially as there are, different strains out there. And it seems like here in the U.S., we're mostly experiencing the L strain. That's what's coming out of Italy and the more virulent one. But, you know, at any given point, that can change. About 20% will develop a severe case and need medical support to survive. Severe cases tend to take about 3 to 6 weeks to recover. And about 6% may need intubation because they can no longer breathe on their own. Much of the difference in death rates between Wuhan at 5.8% and the rest of China at 0.4 to 0.7% stems from the difference in ability to provide care for the critical cases. I don't think the Chinese numbers have a whole lot of accuracy myself, but I think the relationship between Wuhan and areas where there wasn't a quarantine effect before the spread happened, that the caseload was 10 times worse and the fatality rate was 10 times worse, actually seems to fit the evolving picture. And if it isn't right, it's closer to the neighborhood of correct than the idea that we're going to have a much lower rate. And we see the spike in Italy, I think, as proof of that at this point in time. And unfortunately, absent quarantines in the West, that's something we are going to have to deal with. And the United States is going to have to deal with. I worry what the panic buying is spreading. And if you just have one person walking in there who manages to get a critical point sick, how many people will get this virus? We don't know. Once a person is on the ventilator, it often takes about 4 weeks for them to get out of the ICU again. That's a very slow turnaround. If we set this as our estimate, we can calculate how many people are simultaneously in need of medical resources. The curve with numbers, and he puts a picture in here, which basically shows a really huge bell curve over, you know, the x-axis, and a very low line beneath it that overwhelmingly 90% of the curve is over. More than 90%, let's say. If we assume that 55% of Americans catch COVID-19 until the end of 2020, and 6% of them, 10.8 million, will need ventilators at some point, and we furthermore simplify the model into a normal distribution, a symmetric bell curve with a steep exponential onset, a gradual flattening once people get immune, and a gradual fall off as cases resolve, we get the following diagram. The line near the bottom, that's our limited supply of ventilators and intensive care beds. The red curve does not contain all cases of COVID-19, but only those 6% that will die if we can't put them on a ventilator for something like 4 weeks. In this scenario, it means that the maximum number of cases needing care on the same day without any kind of mitigation is around 3 million. It's clear that we desperately need to flatten this curve because it means that for much of the year, the vast majority of cases will not even get assessed for intubation and critical care. So he uses 3 million, that's about 1 in 100. And I've been a little more skeptical in my announcements, but you know, that's actually a really similar estimate. If you understand the exponential modeling, it's actually, we're very much in the same neighborhood. And I think one of the other things he doesn't mention is that there are two other constraining factors, which is the number of medical workers who are available to man this, because people are going to burn out. You know, you need to, if you were at a war, you need to relieve units from the frontline duty and put them back there. But when you're in an all hands on deck situation for potentially 60, 90 days or more, you're going to have burnout, you're going to have sickness, you're going to have casualties and fatigue on that front line. You have that issue. And then we have the unknown issue of what the medical supplies are for treatment. You know, do the ventilators break down? How durable are they? Do we have not having the medicines we need to go ahead and help with that, or oxygen supplies, or these other issues? We don't have any indication these are going to be issues, but this is an event that would not be in standard planning. Much of the planning that was done for this event, if you want to do the research on your own, it goes back to influenza planning, because that's probably the closest model we've had for something like COVID, where we did expect a number of pneumonia cases, but that's a much lower percentage we would have expected than what we're dealing with here, which is 50 to 100 fold times greater use of ventilators. Okay, so let's continue. How far would we need to spread a normal distribution to make sure that it fits below the limit of our medical resources? The flattening the curve idea suggests that if we wash our hands and stay home while being sick aggressively enough, we won't have to stop the virus from becoming endemic and infecting the 40 to 70% of all people, but we could slow the spread of infection so much that our medical system could deal with the caseload. This is how our normally distributed curve looks like when it contains 10.8 patients, of which more than 170,000 are ill at the same time. Depending on the infection rate of COVID to a level that is compatible with our medical system means we would have to spread the epidemic over more than a decade. And you can see here that he charts this over the number of days, if you don't want it to go too high, that you literally would have to go over 4,000 days. And of course, one thing that would change in this, so just to be fair to the model, is presumably if the shortfall was lack of medical workers, lack of ICU support, and lack of ventilators, within the course of 10 years, you would hope even our governments could figure out how to build more of them. So this is a little bit hyperbolic, but it's demonstrative of just showing how the data that you're being presented in many cases, they use the New York Times graph here to show, is not indicative of the problem, and that one of the things that we need to do from a policy perspective is begin solving these issues and these shortfalls, which is going to be lack of protective equipment, lack of available healthcare workers, lack of hospital capacity, lack of ventilators, and lack of medication. The more of that you can get, the quicker of that you can get, the more you can handle more capacity, process people, and hopefully get to the spot of herd immunity in the best case scenario. And in the worst case scenario, having those resources and training up will work if we have a seasonal recurrence of this with mutant strains. This is very bad news that we have to prepare for, but honestly, we would be derelict if we did not assume that COVID is going to come back again in a different form. And the idea that we are waiting for a vaccine to come around to protect us is perhaps illusory in terms of being a hope, because what may happen is a divergent mutated strain of COVID might not be able to be handled by a vaccine in the same way that a different seasonal variant of flu is not protected against by a flu shot. So those are things that you're going to need to be aware of, right? So let's say, far to the left, you will see our unmitigated distribution for comparison. I am pretty confident we will find effective treatments before then, but you get the idea. Reducing the infectivity of the new coronavirus to manageable level is not going to be possible by mitigation. It will require containment. My curves are not correct, he says, as a possible objection. My back-of-the-envelope calculation is not a proper simulation or good model of what's going on either. Don't cite it as such. In reality, the spread of a disease does not follow a normal distribution. It's going to be left skewed with a long tail. There's always going to be some effective mitigation, prevention of public gatherings, conferences, non-essential travel. The model is quite sensitive to the length of the stay in the ICU. If we get that down, and that's where the chloroquine zinc treatments and remdesivir Trafana, Vero, those things come in. Fewer people will need those resources simultaneously, and the peaks of the curves will come down. That's why we need to get these protocols out there and let doctors know what's happening. And we're accomplishing that. I mean, the system isn't, but doctors are talking to one another. And thank God, you know, we live in an open service world. The internet has prevented. If we did not have the internet, this plague would be so much worse. So I'm grateful for that and for the information that's been able to spread. Because if we were just going right through proper sources like we would have done even as early as 30 years ago, this would be a total mess. Even less than that, maybe 25 years ago. So that's good. We may be able to fight the inflammation during pneumonia and reduce the number of critical cases. The available medical resources will increase over time to deal with the need. Regulations will be dropped. In fact, that happened yesterday. New treatments will be explored and some will work. At some point in the near future, we may have to blow into a tube before we enter an airplane or an important public building, and a little screen tells us within seconds if our airways hold COVID, H1N1, the common flu. But the point of my argument is not that we are doomed or that 6% of our population has to die, but that we must understand that containment is unavoidable, should not be postponed, because later containment is going to be less effective, more expensive, and leads to additional deaths. Containment works. China has demonstrated to us that containment works. The complete lockdown of Wuhan did not lead to starvation or riots. Well, we don't know what happened there, and I think that's a little bit dangerous. We have a lot of stories that people died in place, and that, well, anyways, let's hope it doesn't go that way here. And it has allowed the country to prevent the spread of a large number of cases into other regions. This has made it possible to focus more medical resources on the region it needed it most. For instance, by sending more than 10,000 extra doctors to Wuhan and the Hubei region. Wuhan, the epicenter of the outbreak, now observes less than 10 cases per day. The rest of that region registered no new cases for over a week now. I think that's probably true, actually, the more I think about it, this is really down, but why it happened. The problem is, though, as they say, is China's a country with 1.3 billion people, 1.4 billion people, and they sent all their doctors to one place. America, a country of 330 million people, roughly, is having this everywhere at once. The reinforcements are not coming. Gandalf is not coming over the hill, unfortunately, to rescue you at Helm's Deep. So what do we have to do? Maybe start diving into the mountain there. But anyway, China learned its lesson. After the lockdown of Hubei, other regions implemented effective containment measures as soon as the first cases emerged. The same happened in Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea tracked its first 30 cases very well until patient 31 infected over 1,000 others on a church congregation. For some reason, and he puts this in highlight, Western countries refused to learn the lesson. Italy thought they could get away with letting the virus spread until their hospitals collapsed under the load and older people or those with a history of cancer, organ transplants, or diabetes were excluded from access to critical care. The U.S. and U.K. and Germany are not yet at this point. They try to flatten the curve by implementing ineffective or half-hearted measures that are only meant to slow down the spread of the disease instead of containing it. They're reacting and mitigating instead of being active. That's my interjection, that last sentence. And that is a problem. There will be some countries that do not have the necessary infrastructure to implement severe containment measures, which include widespread testing, quarantines, movement restrictions, travel restrictions, work restrictions, supply chain reorganization, school closures, child care for people working in critical professions, production and distribution of protective equipment and medical supplies. This means that some countries will stomp out the virus and others will not. In a few months from now, the world will turn into red zones and green zones, and almost all the travel from red zones into green zones will come to a halt until an effective treatment for COVID-19 is found. And, you know, you would predict in the end that the green zones will be those parts of the developing or developed world that pulled through, and the red zones will be the developing world that will get pummeled. The one thing that will help the people in the, and this is me interjecting, the developing world for those Africa, Latin America countries that are not so well developed, is the fact that a lot of people in those countries, frankly, already die from preventable diseases, and that alone may suppress the rate just a little bit. But it's going to blow hot and hard through there. It may never really be identified as, and we're never going to know how many people died from COVID, but we're going to have a lot of them die, and we'll see. So flattening the curve is not an option for the US, UK, or Germany. Don't tell your friends to flatten the curve. Let's start containment. You know, I mean, and honestly, to be more precise, you go ahead and you practice containment, you are flattening the curve. You're just going ahead and taking yourself off the axis. which is really what you need to do. You know, he didn't include in here, I mean, and not directly, he talks about supply chain organization. One of the problems that governments look at when they're looking at this, and this may be, in fairness to them, a reason why they have trouble doing these calculations, is that when you shut down people moving in the economy, when people are not prepared, you end up with other issues, civil disorder, quarantine riots, lack of food supply, people being sick in housing. And in China, like I'm reporting, like I've heard from multiple Chinese sources, you know, people were getting sick, people were dying at home. I've seen one example of that in Italy, many in Iran. So these are problems that also do get balanced, and how you balance these is really at the heart of this question. And ideally, the government should say, get all your supplies, go stay home for 45 days. Instead, what did we have yesterday? Well, we had President Trump get up there, and he talked about some developments we had, that there's going to be an app coming out from Google, which Google says now today is not going to happen, to help people, that we're going to have drive-through check-ins at Walmart, which sounds good, I guess, in theory, but they still don't have critical reagents for the testing. And we had a parade of CEOs from the private sector that went up there, and they were talking about all their desire to help, which I have no doubt is very heartfelt and true, and that's good that they're looking at supply chain issues and getting private buy-in. But what I did not see was the full development of a plan, just the promises that we continue to see that they've got this, and they went out there to present that there is no panic, need for panic, and that people are ready. Now, is that true? Is that not true? Well, we're going to have to judge by the fruits of their actions, and we're going to have to see, do they move towards quarantines? Do they move quickly to prevent this? Every 4 days is the number we've been using for a little while as an estimate. 2 times the amount of people are going to have this. Every 8 days, 4 times the amount of people. Every 12 days, 16 times the amount of people. And you just go on and on, keep multiplying times two. The longer we wait, the worse it gets. And remember, in the United States, we are reporting at this moment, I'll hit F5 so that you have an accurate number, as of right this second, according to COVID-19info.live, 2,176 confirmed cases with 47 deaths, but we probably have a substantially higher number than that. I would be stunned if the number is not well into the five figures, and it would not surprise me if it's into the six figures. So let's just pretend for the moment, today's date, March 14th, we have 100,000 cases, given that there have been a lack of tests, and probably people have had this and recovered. You hear stories of people who say they've been through that, and I'm glad for those people. If that's the case, then we would expect 8 days from now to be at 400,000 cases, and that 12 days from now, which would be seen reasonable movement in the world of Washington, where the Congress is going on recess and where, you know, these issues exist, by March 26th, in theory, we could have gone to 800,000 cases, and that would mean by the beginning of April, we would be up on 1 million cases in the United States of America. We have not put in quarantines, and this is why I am predicting and projecting that we absolutely will see them. We will see towns, communities act earlier to do that. My personal projections for some time, based upon what I have seen, the way governments look at these things and questions, is cities I would expect to be quarantined sooner than later. For our audience, we'll go around the world real fast. I would think Sydney would be high on that list. Melbourne, just because of its size. London will be, obviously. As we look in the, of course, you're going to see that in Madrid, they had a bad group, Paris, anywhere that's near the Alps really got pounded in Europe because they were close to the Italian outbreak, a lot of economic activity, a lot of sickness. In the United States, cities I expect to be seeing quarantine sooner rather than later. I think the first ones are going to be Boston, New York. It wouldn't surprise me if Atlanta does. Atlanta's got some problems having the CDC around there. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle. I think those are probably your first ones. And behind that, you see cities like Chicago, Philadelphia, D.C. All of them are going to get there, but I think some cities work proactively on this. New York and Boston are really high on my radar for that, as are San Francisco and Seattle. I think if I had to pick four, once you see one city do it, a whole bunch of other ones will do it. But if they declare it before they do it, you're going to be stuck in place. You better be ready to be stuck in place, because they're going to slap this on you out of nowhere, because at some point the panic will come. And this, what they did for the stock market, honestly, was designed to forestall panic over this weekend, because that jump of 2,000 points is going to be given all back in 2 or 3 days if they even open the markets. And what you're going to see is that as the spread of this disease goes out there, even the efforts to roll out testing aren't going to do you a lot of good, because the government can say we're going to roll out testing, go to Walmart. What are you going to do? People are going to go to Walmart. They're going to go get this testing done. They're going to go into Walmart, try to buy supplies from the now empty shelves. And you're going to have this issue where they're going to potentially be spreading it when they go in there, as well as the fact you're going to have a lot of people moving around with economic activity, feeling confidence that the government has this. The government is trying to do what governments do, which is prevent panic, which is a good idea in most situations, in all situations. But the way that they're going about it by minimizing the risk is going to lead to a larger death toll. And I will say that I think this is true of all of these governments and all of these people. They need to be more serious about it and say, look, if we want to avoid having this many people get sick and this many people die, you need to stay the F home. That's what you need to do. Use this weekend. You got 2 days. Get to wherever you are. Then you're in place. You have what you are. The government needs a relief strategy like the old Berlin airlift that happened in the Cold War, where we have logistical planning and use those network contacts with Walmart, Amazon, those other actors, and you'll do that. And otherwise, when you're wondering what's going to happen, we want to be optimistic. And look, I'm not here to make you panic, but I will tell you something. When you see rats scurrying from the ship, that's when you've got to be getting prepared. I think it's interesting that Bill Gates yesterday resigned from the Microsoft board, and I only presume he's on his way to a bunker somewhere to ride out this. You do what they do. You don't do what they tell you to do. You understand that? That's how you need to approach it. So let's talk about what President Trump put out there. There were some good ideas in this, but once again, it's a question of scope and scale. So Trump declared a national emergency to combat coronavirus, authorizing waiving of laws and regulations. This is by Adam Edelman, Peter Alexander, and Kristen Welker, and this was from 4 p.m. yesterday. President Donald Trump on Friday announced a new series of measures to combat the coronavirus and treat those who are affected, while pushing back on criticism that his administration was unprepared to confront the pandemic. Speaking in the White House Rose Garden, Trump declared a national emergency that could free up $50 billion to fight the pandemic, and said he was empowering Secretary of Health and Human Services to waive laws and regulations to ensure the virus can be contained in patients' treatment. To unleash the full power of the federal government, I am officially declaring a national emergency. He said the action would open up access to $50 billion for states, territories, and localities in our shared fight against disease. Flanked by Vice President Mike Pence, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, and other top federal officials and corporate executives from companies such as Walmart, Trump said that the ability to waive certain laws and regulations would allow for easier admission to nursing homes and end the limits on the length of hospital stays and beds available. He also announced 1.4 million new tests for the coronavirus would be available next week, and 5 million would be available within the next month, although he added that I doubt we'll need that quantity. And the problem is, you and I can do math if we have the number. In fact, we will need that quantity to find the people who will have this within, about 24 to 32 days, depending on your modeling. He also said there were plans for drive-through virus tests. In an unusual and lengthy news conference, a parade of business leaders took turns speaking after Trump before the president and other federal officials made other additional key announcements to the administration's coronavirus response. And the news doesn't seem to understand why he did that, but I will tell you that he had all the business leaders talk about how confident they were, how on board they were at government at 3:45 p.m. Eastern Time. For those who don't follow stocks, the stock market closes at 4 p.m., and the stock market gained about 7 percentage points over the course of that, nine plus points on the day. And all of that happened because they projected strength and the market wanted to rebound. So a buying spat of basically panic buying, it's called a dead cat bounce, happened that was designed to project calm and have people maybe go into this weekend feeling a little optimism before they get blasted with terrible news next week. Not the worst idea, actually, if you were trying to manipulate the public into not panicking overwhelmingly this weekend as they go out there and buy. You know, a lot of times, one of the things that we deal with from public officials, and this isn't necessarily a great thing, but I will tell you, it's a thought that is commonly expressed for people who have political experience, yours truly included, is sometimes you tell the people what they need to hear instead of what they need to know. Now, I don't approve of that. That's why I got fired from my job when I said something that was politically incorrect. But ultimately, in a situation like this, the trade-off of doing that is you're buying time for other actions to happen at the expense of people being really unprepared and pissed off later. So next week, when we have quarantines, this looks terrible, And we're making fun of the fact that the president went up there and said Walmart and McDonald's will save us. Understand that that time needed to buy something. I can only hope that behind the scenes that things are happening that will make use of that time. And I have a little bit of evidence maybe to suggest that that might be happening. How much do we want to put into that? I honestly can't tell you, but I'm going to give you the evidence, analysis of what could be happening, what I hope is happening, and that's what's not happening. Anyway, so after the corporate leaders spoke, Trump and other officials finally announced other measures to control the pandemic, waiving of interest on federal student loans, purchase of large quantities of oil for the U.S. Strategic Oil Reserve, and they're offering guidance to suspend all visitations to nursing homes, with exceptions being made for end-of-life situations. Small, useful measures, raindrops in the ocean. We need a lot more. But the Dow Jones went up 2,000 points, up 9-4%. And it goes here. There's a whole bunch of things in here about questions with the reporters. I'm going to skip that. And I'm going to skip that because, honestly, I could spend all day having the media take shots at the president or the president take shots at the media. They can kill each other. That's fine. I mean, honestly, it will probably make things work better for the rest of us if they do. But, frankly, that's not our goal. Our goal is survival and how this is going to benefit us. So I'm not going to go into the snippiness of this because it just isn't useful to us. And a lot of these articles are that way. And the fact in the United States, we still see this in a partisan construct. And I give a lot of blame to the administration. They're fighting over Medicare rules and all these things. I told you, if you guys can't agree on what to do for the long term, sunset everything to the duration of the coronavirus and start putting resources in play. They're simply not doing this. They're reacting. The time to test to prevent the problems and do what South Korea was doing was when South Korea did it. If you implement 3 weeks too late, policies that would have made sense a month earlier, all you will be doing is guaranteeing that you have not devoted your energies and resources to what you will functionally need, which is the ability to mitigate this pandemic, as the article by Mr. Bach said, by going ahead and going into quarantine. At this point, an intelligent government response would be to anticipate the needs of people who will be locked in their homes for a period of time that is going to be no less than 30, and I suspect at least 60 days, given the fact that it will be permeable, people will be sick, and they'll have to space out what's happening. The longer we wait, the bigger that is, the less people can get food. If you have a 60-day quarantine, okay, and you have 30% of the people can't get food, they're going to go out. And if they go to the supermarket and they can't get, they're going to begin riots. They're going to have people marching through the streets. This is when the quarantine fails, the disease goes crazy, and you get the max die-off rate. I'm not saying that's going to happen. I don't want that to happen. We don't want that to happen. Stay home. Anyway, in the article, under the Stafford Act, an infectious disease emergency declaration by the president would allow FEMA to provide disaster relief funding to state and local governments, as well as the federal assistance to support the coronavirus response. The law allows the agency to circumvent legal barriers to more quickly distribute such aid. Emergency declarations are most often used in the event of natural disasters, but can also be applied to other disease outbreaks. So a bunch of fights here about, who's responsible, a lot of blame to go around there, and the bans on different people, health officials. Okay, so that's what we're dealing with. And I will say, if the government is thinking that they're going to solve this in terms of throwing money at the problem, like the Federal Reserve has done at the market, or like, quite frankly, the congressional aid approach is put out there, putting money in the problem, you're still thinking about it wrong. You have to think, what are the valuable resources we need? How do we produce them? How do we distribute them? How do we survive this? We need to shut down our economy to the greatest extent possible and make sure that people have what they need to survive this. You're going to need information. Hopefully they keep the internet, the power up. You're going to need warmth. You're going to need security. Basic prepper stuff, right? You're going to need shelter. You need to be in place and know you're not going to get sick. Food, you need to have the ability to feed yourself and keep healthy. Medicine, whatever you need in place. If you get sick, the medical system has to be there. Don't get sick so that the medical system can be there. Clean water, hopefully they're looking at that. That's a basic thing. Protection, if the government doesn't cover itself, you want to take care of yourself through whatever means you can. And those are the questions that they need to be thinking about. They're still thinking about mitigation in a way because I think at some level they just don't understand their own numbers. I don't know why the epidemiologists can't seem to get through. And it's not, I mean, it is the administration. I'm not exonerating them. But it's also a lot of people in Congress. I guess, I hate to say this, but a lot of our politicians, frankly, just don't seem that smart. And I say that, including from the very top up, they just don't seem to be able to wrap their head around this idea of exponential growth and the idea to look like they want to do something and subjugating this and thinking how we come out the other side of this in terms of personal benefit is just not the way we need to be thinking about it. When you are in a war for survival, if you take this anything less than seriously, you end up with this terrible death toll. And I think it has to be said, and it's a terrible thing, but the UK, Boris Johnson has certainly said it. A lot of the governments seem to be thinking, well, you know what? I would rather deal with a 10% death rate, get through it quick, and have, you know, deal with whatever the wreckage is on the other side, than have this long thing that changes the society in ways we don't want. And that's a choice, but that's a choice, it's a suicidal choice, where you're basically saying, I would rather die than change who I am. This is a time of change, my friends. We have to do that, and we are walking into a new world. So what do we expect to see in the future? I'm going to close with an article by the Military Times here. This is from the DOD. This is by Leo Shane III, and it's from 7 hours ago. So it would have been around 1 a.m. this morning. I don't know why they published it then, but maybe the order came out at midnight. DOD bans all domestic travel for personnel and families amid coronavirus. Pentagon officials on late Friday announced a total domestic travel ban for all troops, civilian personnel, and their families until May 11th, okay? So that's 2 months from now, which means they're expecting 60 days of disruptions, in an effort to limit their potential exposure to the coronavirus. In addition, troops will only be granted only authorized local leave for the duration of the travel restrictions, limiting their ability to visit friends and family in faraway states. And I bet there are going to be communication restrictions too soon. The continuing spread of the 2019 novel coronavirus necessitates immediately implementation of travel restrictions for domestic DOD travel, the memo announcing the new travel rules stated. These restrictions are necessary to preserve force readiness, limit the continuing spread of the virus, and preserve the health and welfare of service members, DOD civilian employees, their families, and the local communities in which we live. The travel ban goes into effect on Monday, March 16th. So, you know, the military bases are shutting down. They're going to be the first ones acting. The rest of us won't be far behind. And though they're saying these are 14-day things, there's a 24-day things, yeah, we're going to be shut down for the next 60 days. There you go. It comes just after days after Pentagon officials announced severe restrictions on overseas travel for all defense employees, uniformed, and civilians. The new rules cover permanent change of station moves and temporary duty travel. All D&D military personnel will stop moving while this memorandum is in effect, Deputy Secretary of Defense David Nordquist wrote in the announcement. Exceptions to the travel stoppage will be made for patients and medical providers, as well as families. Individuals who have already begun travel will be allowed to complete their trips in coming days. Troops approaching retirement or separation are exempt, but officials warn those exceptions will be limited in number and must be approved by senior military leaders, including the combatant commanders and service secretaries. Defense Department hiring practices will also be impacted. Until the domestic travel restrictions prescribed above are lifted, DOD components may only onboard civilian employees within the local commuting area. Earlier on Friday, President Donald Trump declared the coronavirus outbreak a national emergency, allowing his administration to tap into $50 billion for public health response methods. Let's see here. Just reading through. Okay, and the rest of this is stuff about the U.S. It's not important. So, you know that. So here's what we know. So this is good information. They are buying some time this weekend, potentially, knowing that this is going to get worse, for one last chance to get ready. It's Saturday at 9 a.m. Get yourself prepared. Get close to your family. Get to where you want to be. A lot of people have written me, should I be traveling home? Should I be where I want to be? If you're not on the road already listening to this, what the hell are you waiting for? An invitation? You need to be where you need to be in place sometime next week, depending on factors that, frankly, we don't know. Governments in the United States, and I expect we'll see the same in Canada, Australia. The U.S.'s lead will basically open up the rest of the world to do so. And you're going to see it sooner in Germany and Spain and France, in this mitigation containment phase. They're going to have to do this. They're going to have no choice. Hopefully, they're able to ramp up production. And by doing this through this containment effort, basically take big chunks out of that curve and keep this down to a manageable crisis. If we do this, if it happens now, if there's only a couple hundred thousand cases, can you prevent the worst of the human tragedy? If the quarantine holds, if people are not going out there, if other factors don't intervene, and if this virus isn't something horrible that manages to slip quarantine, because we have to remember, in Wuhan, it still kept spreading even after the quarantine for a while. I remember this study. I think it was in The Lancet, but I can't remember it for sure, that the quarantine reduced the spread rate from 7 to 3, which flattened the hell out of the curve, but it still wasn't enough given the number of people who had already started it. And I just don't know. We don't know how much the spread has happened in these last few weeks. We don't know the raw numbers of what we're dealing with. But we do know that whatever we experience, the one way we can guarantee to burn it out is to contain in place and try to let it go away. So that's what the government's going to try because, you know, to use the old Churchill quote, Americans will do everything wrong until they do the last thing. And that will save many, many lives. And it's a necessary step in terms of dealing with the virus. And like I said, you have to beat the virus before you beat anything else. And then while we go through that and as we go through that, hopefully we have the capacity to deal with these other issues and that we are not in such a terrible spot that things fall apart. And that depends on all of us, how we deal with it. In terms of what you do for yourself and your family, this is an opportunity to get ready, get to the places where you need to be. I've shared a lot of information with you today's episode specifically to give you the mental and physical preparation you need of what to expect. We know from Italy what's out there. We know the quarantines are coming. We know what the government's doing right now is putting lipstick on a pig. That's not going to be enough, and we hope and pray they have the wisdom to act intelligently. Whether they do or not, you make sure you do. Help. One last thing as you go through this, talk to people in your community, policymakers, let them know what's happening. Those people who haven't listened to you yet, it might be annoying at times to talk to them now that they're panicked. You need to settle them down, say you do not need to panic, you need to prepare. What are going to be your risks? Make an assessment going forward. Go ahead and address them before you have to. And ride it out, man. I'll be here with you trying to be the voice of calmness and reason. And we'll see what happens. It's going to be a crazy world. This year is only going to get nuttier. We don't know what we don't know. But you know what you do in a battle? You survive the firefight. The first invasion swarm is in on our countries. Now is the time we have to survive. We weren't ready for their attack. It was a surprise attack, but we're going to do this. The war on the coronavirus continues, and we are the Army of Humanity. You know, tomorrow, I'll close with this. Tomorrow's the National Day of Prayer. Some people who listen to this believe in this deeply. Some don't. You know I do. I'm a Christian, and I'm going to pray for all of us here. Just ask the Heavenly Father that you bring us relief from this terrible plague that has been set upon us, that you bring health to the sickly, and that you allow us to learn from this example how to be better people, better servants in accordance with your will and seek a higher truth. So just going to say that as my own personal belief and hope that mercy and grace that we all get through this together. And, you know, for me, I'll just share this little quick story before I go. You know, it would have been the easiest thing in the world for me to sit up here in my cab and watch this and, you know, not say anything. But the hope and the prayer was that we were helping a lot of people. Stories that have been shared with me of the inspiration of various people who went out there and who listened and who reached other people, saved them. You know, people who hopefully will be friends in the future. I mean, whatever we disagreed upon, whatever we didn't do, my hope is we can talk to one another, persuade one another, and find ways to... We've been in a world for a very long time where we lived in fantasy and we didn't deal with reality. Reality is suffering, and it's painful, and it's brought us back to this. But we also now are speaking to one another in a way we haven't in a long time. Let's hope we can continue that we work past our disagreements and that we find that something good comes out of something terrible. Because the truth is, a lot of terrible things were about to happen anyway, and as terrible as this is, and I wouldn't wish on anyone, that maybe there is a silver lining in all this to be found in that. So something to think about as you go through the weekend. I'm Tom Kaczynski. This is Coronavirus Central. We'll be back Monday morning. Keep tuned to at Coronavirus Cast. You will not see me much on Sunday. I'll be out praying and resting. My wife is going to claim me, and hopefully blessed sleep will as well. You guys have a great weekend. Keep safe. Get to where you need to be. We'll talk about it on Monday. I know there will be a lot of news. Have a good day.